Welcome, welcome, welcome to Looking California, Feeling Minnesota, everybody's favorite cinema podcast. My name is Michael McCaffrey. I'm the Looking California portion of this program. I'm out here in sunny Southern California, and I am an acting coach and a writer. And I'm joined by
Barry Anderson. I'm a director based in Minneapolis, which, it's an interesting time here in my hometown.
Yeah, for people who don't know or who are listening later down the line, there's some stuff going on in Minneapolis right now that, you know, Barry's in the middle of, as always. There are some riots and there, you know, all this sort of business. And Barry, from what he told me before we started recording, he ended up torching a liquor store last night. And
you single-handedly never want to get me hired again on another job, so I just want to thank you for that. Yeah, no, it's a weird.
Yes,
weird.
How's the weather in Minneapolis? Is it sort of they're just smoke clouds overhead or what?
Well, ironically enough, literally the next 3 days are supposed to be like 70 degrees and sunny. It's going to be like perfect weather on the backdrop of civil unrest.
Oh man, it's going to be no good.
Unfortunate.
Okay, so moving on to lighter topics, I guess. The film we're talking about today is The Last Samurai, starring Tom Cruise. It came out in December of 2005. It was directed by Edward Zwick and had a budget of $140 million and made $450 million. It was a big, big Hollywood movie. A lot of hype around this movie. It was nominated for 4 Academy Awards. Didn't win any, I don't think. It was, you know, none of the big awards, just sort of secondary things. But the film stars Tom Cruise, Timothy Spall, Ken Watanabe, Billy Connolly, Tony Goldwyn. And it's the story of what year does this thing take place? God help me.
I think it was 1860s or 1880s.
Yeah. So 1860s must be, or 1880s, something. So Tom Cruise plays a U.S. Captain in the 7th Cavalry Regiment who is having trouble coming to terms with the things he did in the war against the Indians. But he gets hired to go to Japan and fight for the Japanese government against the last remnants of the samurai warriors. It is loosely based on a true story, very loosely. But it involves samurai stuff, which I'm on board with. Big fan. I love that stuff, man. So we're going to talk about The Last Samurai, everybody. So buckle up. This, by the way, I want to make this entirely clear right now. This was Barry's choice. Barry chose this movie. And if you think the riots in Minneapolis are bad right now, if I were there making me watch this movie, I almost rioted. This was rough for me.
As I stated prior to the podcast, I'm very curious to find out if you like this movie at all. And I think everybody listening right now knows the answer prior to us digging into this in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, so
I'm gonna defend myself on two fronts. Yes, I did pick this movie. I think the last time I saw this movie was in the theater, and I did not want to go see it, but my friend dragged me to it, and I remembered enjoying it much more than I was thinking I would when I went into it. That being said, on whatever week 57 of quarantine, and we're trying to pick things off of streaming services. This is what happens to people. This is real life. Most movies are not the greatest movies ever. And I think there's things to like about the movie. I think there's things that don't work very well. And I think it's a movie that has not aged particularly well. On
no. Oh, dear.
It's definitely.
No, it hasn't. Oh, boy. Yeah.
But yeah, I'll let you, since I picked it, I'll let you give the first breakdown.
Okay, well, here I had my experience with the film was the exact opposite of yours. I was excited to see it when it first came out. I did samurai movies. I liked the whole mystique, the the whole thing about samurai. So I was on board. I was ready to roll. I thought it was a great idea for a movie, and it's a great story, but it is just, it's so paint by numbers. It's just the most sort of contrived. It's everything that's awful about Hollywood is in this movie. And by the way, it runs, the runtime is 154 minutes.
Yeah, it's long.
So 2.5 hours. And I start watching this thing on Netflix. And all of this stuff is happening. And Tom Cruise is in it. This is like Apex Mountain for the worst of Tom Cruise. He like brings everything that's terrible about Tom Cruise, he does in this movie. And it's just like, oh, good Lord. And Edward Zwick is like in the Hack Hall of Fame, this guy. It's incredible how successful this guy's been, and he doesn't know what in the hell he is doing. And I'm watching this movie, and all this stuff is happening. Tom Cruise, by the way, is playing an alcoholic. He plays Captain Nathan Algren, as he's described here on Wikipedia, a bitter alcoholic traumatized by the atrocities he committed during the American Indian Wars. So just imagine Tom Cruise, a pretty limited actor, playing drunk. And it's like a bad high school play. And I'm watching this thing and I'm like, oh God. And I click the control to see how much time is left in the movie. And I was only like 15 minutes in. And I'm like, are you kidding me right now? Like, this is the longest movie ever made. It feels like it's 9 hours long. It's incredible. The pacing is brutal. It does not flow at all. And I'm sitting there just
crying
out in despair watching this thing, because it's a great idea. And well, it could have been a great
story
movie.
Is really amazing. And I think it stands in stark contrast to our previous podcast, The Social Network, which was also a lengthy movie about a very boring topic that screamed along. And I think part of what I love about, I think there's something interesting about art and cinema. I think there's times where you see movies and you don't get them. And if you revisit them, you're like, oh, I totally missed that. I think sometimes it speaks to you differently at different times in your life when you have different experiences. I think there is certain cases where things are great, but then as you grow up, maybe your tastes become more sophisticated. You're like, that humor is not as funny as I once thought. Or in a case like this, where I think this was the apex. I think this was part of the last of the death of the pre-golden era Hollywood film, where you had movies that were kind of orchestrated. We got the idea, we got the major movie star, we got the backdrop. And if we just execute it like this, it will make money. And it did. And I think if you would do that same thing now, let's say you take like Chris Pratt and put him in here and remake this movie, I think it does not make almost $500 million worldwide. And I think it takes a ton of heat. And I don't think it has a shelf life. So I think that's what I think is so interesting, is people always talk about, like, you know, a film that was way back when, and it has a life and it changes over time. And I enjoyed watching it from that standpoint, that you see something that in theory is static. You've shot it, you put it on film, you've put it to someone, they've watched the same DVD 2-3 times, but it is different. And I think it's so fascinating to see, you know, how that works, like how it was shot back then. What were the decisions that were made? You know, I think Ken Watanabe is a decent actor. And man alive, I did not think he did a very good job in this movie. And I know it was one of his earlier American movies, and I know English as a second language sometimes is difficult to pull off nuance, but there was very little nuance in this movie. It was kind of like, I killed your husband and we both feel bad about it, but by the way, you're cute and I'm cute, and so we're going to flirt a lot. And you're like, right. It's not shown. It's expected. Oh, okay. Right. Now look at him cutely. Okay. Look at her cutely. Okay. Now go back to being silent. Yeah, all right. Done.
Everything's a cliche. Like, no, it's 100%. Just talking about that, like there's the cliched scene of him walking sort in on her bathing in the waterfall, you know, and it's like, what cover of a romance novel did they steal this idea from? You know, and then like, you know, of him saving the kid, you know, like, and what the movie really is you're right. I mean, things change historically and over time, but this movie came out in 2003.
Did you say three or five?
Oh, no, it's 03, December of 2003. And it really is just it takes from the formula of Dances with Wolves is really what it does. And it's 12 years after Dances with Wolves, which, you know, so you have the American going into a quote-unquote foreign culture, sort of appropriating that culture for learning how to love it, respect it, and all these things, which of course nowadays, like, that would be labeled appropriation and you could do it, but that's what Cruise does. And like, it's the basic sort of blueprint, but it's 12 years later. Like this movie, The Last Samurai, feels like it should be from 1989.
Yeah.
And that's what's so jarring about the movie is that it's not particularly well made, like visually. And the cinematographer is John Tall, who's a very talented guy. And yet the movie is visually flat and dull. There are flashback sequences, which I thought, boy, this seems really, really derivative and sort of cheap. And that's sort of what runs through the whole film. And so it never capitalizes on this idea. And by the time this is made, it's a bit of an outdated idea of, you know, the Dances with Wolves sort of paradigm. And comparing it to Dances with Wolves, it's not even remotely as well made as that movie.
Yeah.
Even just the cinematography, the music. I mean, the soundtrack in this thing is so cloying and so manipulative.
Isn't it Hans Zimmer?
It is Hans. Let me double check. Yeah, it's Hans.
It sounds like Hans, but lacking all of the magic of his best work.
Exactly. And the soundtrack is just like the movie. It lacks any and all sort of nuance and subtlety.
Yeah.
And that's why I find this movie so frustrating, because I was excited to see it. And I think it's a great idea. And we're going to talk in a little bit. I'm going to surprise you with this.
Oh, good.
But
I like that.
I'll give you a chance now to think on it. But us playing Hollywood producer with this thing, I already have ideas of how this could have been a great movie.
Okay.
In recasting and all that. But that was my whole thing. And the movie ends up being just a really sort of, much like most of Zwick's movies, by the way, being just like a good idea that runs amok. That he's simply not skilled or talented enough to pull off. And that's frustrating to me as somebody who loves cinema, as somebody who loves, you know, the samurai and like that, the whole idea of that. And so it's frustrating to me. Movie frustrated me, and I was ready to riot when I watched it.
I'm going to make a correlation again to our previous podcast and The Social Network. I mean, this is the Last Samurai is a movie that had a big enough budget, had enough runway that in theory, as the director, you should have prep time on this. It's not like it was like rushed in production before a strike or something like that. So watching the special features on The Social Network and realizing they had 3 weeks to rehearse with the actors, but it wasn't about rehearsing. It was about the director talking to the actors and talking to the writer and asking why. Why is this in here? Why is this word necessary? What is the meaning? What are they trying to get out of that? So that there was a coherency to the characters, what they were doing, why they were doing it, how the audience is supposed to react. And this movie was like, literally like a 6-year-old was like, and then they kiss, and then the action comes, and then this. And you're like, okay, well, I mean, it's a story, but it's not a tapestry. Like, you don't feel Tom Cruise. The only feeling I got of Tom Cruise's character's journey was what they've shown in many movies. It's been in Glory. It's been in that Unbreakable or Unbroken, where you basically take someone and beat them to within an inch of their life and they can withstand that, and then they stand up a taller man on the other side.
But right, the problem and of course, is, Glory was directed by Zwick.
Correct. Well, yeah. Except for, I mean, that was Denzel Washington's star-making, you know, role. Like, he took yeah. that role, and he owned it, and he, you know, was large. Him and Morgan Freeman shone in that movie. Like, that was their movie. And you felt something. So even though, you know, there are flaws with Glory, there were parts that were elevated, and I didn't feel like there was a single performance in this movie that elevated. Like, you know, like the samurai's right-hand man that didn't like yeah. Tom Cruise. There was never, I mean, then at that scene near the end when he checks him out in his samurai armor and he's like, okay, you're good. I mean, there was never like that, like, you know, brotherhood of like, okay, I'm going to accept you, but there's still tension. I mean, there's just none of it. I mean, there could have been so much better about it. And I think if it was made now, there is a little bit about its appropriation. But I think similar to Dances with Wolves, it was more the white man needed to be redeemed.
Yeah.
And he found it through someone else. It's not like a white savior mentality. It is interesting to say, like, you know, he was basically soulless. Like, you know, he was this mercenary killer for hire that had, you know, he's like, you pay me, I'll go kill whoever you want. And then he realizes there's honor. He realizes there's more to life. And I think that's a good kind of story to be told and a good kind of, you know, moral question that humanity yeah. has to wrestle with. But they certainly didn't wrestle with it. It was just like, here's our theme. And yes. And yes, what? You're just yes. The movie ends.
Right. Yeah.
3 hours yes. later. And you're like, okay, well, that was, I'm glad we debated that. I'm glad there was some back and forth. That wasn't there for us, the audience. The actor and the director might have had it on set, but they didn't put it in the movie.
So Edward Zwick, who Zwick is very, very successful guy. He
very produced, successful.
He produced 30 something, some other TV show too. I can't remember which, but you know, very successful guy. And Once and Again was his other TV show, big TV show in Nashville. But as a director, Here's a list of the films that he's directed. Starting in 1986, About Last Night, Glory, Leaving Normal, Legends of the Fall, Courage Under Fire, The Siege, The Last Samurai, Blood Diamond, Defiance, Love and Other Drugs, Pawn Sacrifice, Jack Reacher, Never Go Back, and Trial by Fire. Now,
wait a minute, was that the third Jack Reacher, or is there two?
How dare you even ask me that? I have no fucking clue. Okay, what so Jack Reacher
the
that
reason,
is.
The reason I have to ask, I can't remember if there's two or three Jack Reachers. I think there's only two. The first Jack Reacher is not a masterpiece, and I definitely think they may be miscast with Tom Cruise. But there was a element to that movie that was like watchable and interesting.
This is the second Jack Reacher.
Okay, then it makes all the sense in the world. there is a fight scene on a staircase that is maybe the worst piece of filmmaking maybe ever created. Oh. I mean, it is, I would be curious for you just to watch that. I mean, it is like a film school student that doesn't know how editing works and how stunt choreography works. It is like, what is happening? This is like a Tom Cruise, like, franchised. How is this possible? And I didn't realize that he had directed that. But yeah. Oh my God, if you thought that this movie was rough, that one scene will just be like, I will never watch another movie that he makes.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the fight scene. In my notes here, I talk about how, in terms of the battlefield stuff, that the geography and geometry of all the battle scenes is an absolute mess in this movie.
Yep.
Like, just, and that is just the most rudimentary thing that you have to deal with making a movie like this.
Yep.
So you think about, for a great example is Braveheart, right?
Yes.
So, you know, Mel Gibson's directing Braveheart, and the key to that movie is making those fight sequences exciting, and so they have a lot of camera movement. But what makes those fight sequences work is that they're coherent.
Yes.
So that as you watch them, you understand what is happening and where it's happening in the context of the bigger battle. And it weaves in with the telling of the story and it reinforces the story. It's not just like, oh, fighting and chaos and stuff like this, which, you know, I've written about and we've talked about just privately. The last season of Game of Thrones and how what made the season falter, especially that the big battle of Winterfell, was that they failed to do that. They tried to convey the confusion of battle, which if you're somebody watching a film or television show, that doesn't work.
Yeah,
right.
Correct.
It doesn't work. You know, even Spielberg with the great opening to Saving Private Ryan, he's able to capture the frenetic energy of battle, but it's never confusing.
Correct.
In fact, he is quite skilled in that sequence at making everything really clear, where he lets the camera, which as we know, it's this almost one long continuous shot, but he lets it settle so that you can get your bearings about you as Tom Hanks is getting his bearings about him, this character, and then you move on. So you always know where you are. You always know where you are in relation to the enemy and what's happening. And in this movie, it's just, it's this chaotic swirl of sort of nothingness. There's a scene at the end.
Go ahead. Are you going to talk about the 300 battle at the end?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
The reason I want to bring it up spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert. I spoiled alert in my pants when I saw this thing. I was like, you got to be shitting me.
So the reason I want to bring it up, and if you want to tell your other scene first, is when you're talking about the coherency, there's the big climactic battle sequence where, you know, I think they state in the movie that they have 500 samurai and it's going against, I don't remember how many legions, but it's like thousands of people that are coming, but they're going to battle and they assume that they're not going to make it through. And what I love is that they basically say, so the setup is they, you know, they let them kind of fire their stuff and then they kind of run around the corner. Run around the corner, sort of like, oh, come get us. And then the one general's like, well, you know, let's go send out an investigatory. And the other guy's like, no, send in our entire army where we don't know. And you're like, wow, this guy's an idiot. So he sends the army around, the invading army, and they start getting slaughtered, but obviously they can outnumber the ones that we see. Well, then you notice that Tom Cruise is off to the side waiting late. So you're like, oh, good. So there's some reinforcements they don't know about that are going to surprise attack them. Then they run out, and it's still like, wow, there's like 100-1 the enemy. So I'm like, even if you're really good, this is not going to go well. And then you're like, oh, so this is the end. Then they're like, nope, there's another cavalry hiding over there on horseback. And you're like, so you're just going to let them slaughter most of you? And then there's four left calling another. And I'm like, I'm not very good at math, but I'm like, that looks like a lot of horses. And there was a lot of people in the other one. I'm like, I kind of feel like we're maybe above 500. And it was just like, you know, they'd never set any of that up. And I know a lot of times in war movies, there's like a trick. But this was like a trick every part of the scene. You're like, oh, it's desperation. Nope, got another trick up my sleeve. Oh, desperation. Nope, another trick. And so all of the tension and all of the stakes, you never know. You're like, well, this is the end. No, it's not the end. And so then you go through the end. You're like, oh, this is the end. They're like, nope, they're going to go around now and go confront the bigger army. And you're like, I don't know when I'm supposed to be excited, scared, or not care because this is going to go on for another 40 minutes. And it's just so poorly not understanding how the audience is going to have the emotional ups and downs of this entire sequence and how they're going to try to track what's happening, where it's happening, and when our so-called hero is in peril or not. They never address any of that. It's just they'll fight, and then when they want them hurt, we'll hurt them. And when we want them okay, they'll be okay. And it's just like, all right, well, so we're in a comic book world where nothing matters. And
right.
At any point, anything can happen. And you're like, well, that's
That's what it becomes. It becomes this weird sort of, it becomes a movie,
yeah. Right?
Where you're just like, oh, yeah, okay. And like in that final battle scene, it's so funny. When it was starting, I was like, okay, well, the movie's got to be over soon. And I checked the time again. And there was like, you know, 45 minutes to go. And I'm like, what are they going to do? So they have this sneaky battle thing, and then they have this sneaky oil out on the field that lights on fire, you know, that routine.
By the way, that oil on fire never paid off into anything.
No.
It starts on fire, and then it's like, well, did it cut them off? No, they're still coming. Did it kill people? Maybe four. So they're like, no. What do we do that for?
Yeah. And then the battle is seemingly over, and then Tom Cruise and Ken Watanabe are like, you know, let's do the whole 300 thing and run right at the rest of the army. And, you know, and they're like, okay. So then they start going at him across this big, long field. It's like the biggest field in the history of the world, because they keep cutting back and forth, and these guys are still riding full speed, right? And it's like it takes 10 minutes for them to get close enough. And then the worst part of the movie, which is saying something, because I'm going to list some of the other worst things. But the worst part is Tom Cruise's former commanding officer when he was in the U.S. Army is Tony Goldwyn, who is like just one of those great, he's Hollywood royalty.
Yeah.
You know, he comes from the Goldwyn family. And so he plays the sort of the bad guy. And he was the bad guy in Ghost, you know, like this is what he's good at. And he's fine in the movie. He does what he usually does, but Tom Cruise is like running at him and they're rivals. And just like every samurai, Cruise throws his samurai sword about 20 yards and gets Goldwyn right in the chest. And I literally am watching this by myself and I'm like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. Jesus Christ. And, you know, and then they're still fighting, people get shot and the whole thing. And then you think like, movie's over. That was tough. And then I check the time again. And there's still 20 goddamn minutes left in this movie. And I'm like, how did that happen? What are we doing? And then you have what I found this to be just absolutely hysterical. The final sequence is Tom Cruise goes to the Japanese emperor's palace and limps the length of this long room, and then has this discussion with the emperor that everyone's so impressed by, and he kneels and all these things. And it's like the height of unintentional comedy, this thing. Watching Cruise just like sell this limp through he does it for 7 minutes on this walk, and it's like, oh, he's such a grizzled veteran. And meanwhile, he's Tom Cruise, and you're like, yeah, okay. He has no depth to him at all through the whole movie. He's supposed to be this haunted man, and it's like, yeah, it's Tom Cruise. He's not haunted. There's nothing haunted this guy. And it's brutal. The other, and I have to say, I have a running joke with another filmmaking friend of mine. We talk about Cruise moments. We both, whenever we see each other, greet each other by saying, Saki! Because in this movie, Tom Cruise, he's in withdrawal from alcohol, and he's a prisoner of the samurai, and he needs alcohol, so he starts yelling for Saki as he's lying on the ground and he's all wounded. And he yells for Saki probably 20 times in this movie, and it is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. It kills me every time. And so whenever I see my buddy, we always are like, Saki, Saki! Cruise kills me in this movie. Absolutely kills me.
I don't understand why they have the sake line. Like, it's weird. It would be like somebody yelling at someone like hamburger. Like, it makes no sense whatsoever. I'm like, the first time I heard it, I was like, did you say sake, or is it like a chant that I just don't understand what they're saying? And then you're
right.
Like, yeah. No, it's sake. Awesome.
No, it's, he needs well sake. Done, so to get back to my original point before you stole the podcast. I listed all of Edward Zwick's movies, which I'm going to do again real quick. About Last Night, Glory, Leaving Normal, Legends of the Fall, Courage Under Fire, The Siege, Last Samurai, Blood Diamond, Defiance, Love and Other Drugs, Jack Reacher, Trial by Fire. You would be hard pressed to find a list more bursting with mediocrities than that one.
Yeah.
And you're talking about movies with huge budgets
and huge stars.
Huge stars.
Yes.
Blood Diamond, Leo was nominated for that movie. It is a terrible movie.
So here's the audience right now is screaming. I can hear them through the ether. So I'm going to be the conduit to ask you this question.
Okay. Okay, fair enough.
What is Edward Zwick's best movie on that list?
Oh, wow. Oh, that's tough, man. You know what I would go with, actually?
Even if you say love and other stuff, I'm going to throw you out.
I was going to say love and other drugs because there's a lot of nudity, which to me, I don't know why you make a movie and there's no nudity in it. What's the sense?
In that movie, he took Jake Gyllenhaal, a great actor, and made him pedestrian at best. Oh,
brutal. What a brutal movie. No, I would say, and maybe I'm saying this because I haven't seen it in so long, but Glory would be mine. Because, I mean, Denzel really is great in that movie, as is Morgan Freeman. The movie is brought down by Matthew Broderick, which, you know, I don't know what that was. I thought that was a good idea.
That is such a weird, that is one of the weirdest choices in movie history.
Yeah.
That I'm kind of glad that Matthew Broderick got the role, because it's like, it's so never a move that would be done that it's kind of awesome that it happened. But it was clearly not the right call. So then here's a question that I think you and I were going to differ on. I figured that was probably what you'd say was his best. What's the second best? Because I think that drop off is really, really steep.
You know, it's funny. My reaction to his movies are always the same, like Blood Diamond, same thing. Like, really a great idea for a movie that's just, it just in execution, it's a mess. Just doesn't work. I don't even know. You know what I'd have to say? Boy, this is depressing. It might be The Last Samurai. That's how bad this list is.
Oh man.
The Last Samurai might be the second best movie on this list. I mean, good Lord.
I'd have to think about it more, but I think I might give a slight nod to Blood Diamond.
It's tough, man. I mean, Blood Diamond, Leo's in it. I think
Leo's performance in that is really good. And I even think, what's his name?
Simon Hanju?
Yeah, Damon Hinchu.
He's in that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did pretty good. There were moments of that movie that, again, kind of like Glory, there were moments that elevated it. I mean, the movie as a whole was not coherent or, you know, well thought out, but I'm just trying to think about movies where there was something that you're like, yeah, okay, I'm proud of that. And there was a few of those in Blood Diamond. Ooftus. That is a brutal
list. Some crazy shit. I'm looking at this right now. So Last Samurai in 03. Edward Zwick won the National Board of Review Award for Best Director. Wow. Holy cow. What is wrong with the National Board of Review? Yikes, man.
Well, I'm telling you, we live in a different world than 2003 was.
Yeah. Like, oh, it's true. I
mean, there's no way that he would win that award for this movie in today's time. No chance.
It's impossible. Jeez. Good old Ed Zwick killing me. So this is The Last Samurai. And, you know, like, to me, I'm a big fan of samurai films and Kurosawa and one of, not just my favorite, but I think one of the handful of greatest actors to have ever acted is Toshirô Mifune, who was great in a ton of Kurosawa films, another film. But you know, when I went to see this movie, I was thinking, oh, what a great idea to, you know, because so many cinephiles and successful directors grew up and loved the Kurosawa sort of samurai genre movies. That this idea would be something that would appeal to a lot of them. And I thought to myself, like, how cool would it be to make a Seven Samurai-esque movie, you know, with those sort of wonderful characters? And like, Mifune is so good in that. And then have like a white American guy be thrown into that narrative and have to navigate that. And like, you know, you could see so many possibilities with that. And so many directors would project themselves onto it, which is, I think, what Zwick does here. So, but that's not what this movie is.
Well, is that movie not what it is, I think you actually stumbled across one of the major reasons that The Last Samurai doesn't hold up, and why it's a flawed movie. Is, tell me if there's this great video out there for people. I'm going to take a pivot and then I'm going to come back to my point. But Star Wars, and you know, for years people were like, "Are the prequels worth it?" You know, versus the originals and all this sort of stuff. And they did this test where they would come out and be like, you know, describe Princess Leia, you know, describe Han Solo. And people go, and they'd be like, you know, describe, you know, whatever, Queen Amidala. And people were like, she wore white. And if you do that with this movie and you ask any character in the movie, there is not a single character. There's no one interesting. There's no one memorable. There's no, it's not like you understand their struggle or there's an interesting trait about them. They are all, okay, you go stand there, you put on that costume and grunt.
Yeah.
You go stand there, you look, you know, sultry and look this way and you're done. And I mean, you know, you're a boy and you're confused. Look up to this man like he's a giant of a man. You know, there's nothing. I mean, I thought that it would be so fun for the Emperor, who's clearly conflicted and kind of like a coward, and it would be just so great to figure out a way to put in there why he is that way and what that internal struggle is, so that the audience, I mean, it was much, much more well executed in Saving Private Ryan, that scene where the one friend is going to be stabbed by the enemy,
yeah,
and the other friend, yeah, comes up, but he's too much of a coward and he stands outside the door and lets his friend be killed. I mean, you want to absolutely wring that guy's neck. And like, you should have had that with the Emperor. You should have been like, oh my God, you have the answers right here. And again, they just never, they're just like, he's a coward. End of sentence. And it,
right.
I learned a lesson working with one of the biggest actors I'd worked with at the point. We did a film, and you know, I now laugh every time I see it in credit when a character in a film doesn't have a name. It's just like guy number three, bad guy, yeah, two. And I remember he came up to me, he's like, what's the guy's name? I'm like, I don't know. And it was his way of politely trying to tell me, like, you're never going to elevate this if you're thinking about it in those terms. Like, these have to be real people with real, you know, decisions, yeah, and real struggles. And it was one of those things where it was really funny because, you know, he was teaching me things, and later on I was like, oh, I'm like, now I get what he was asking for. Wasn't being a jerk about it, but you're like, I get it. And when you watch a movie like this, nobody was saying, who is this person? Why are they doing, right, what they're doing? It's just literally, like you said, it's like a Harlequin romance novel with like two-dimensional characters that have no depth to them. And, you know, I'm an honorable man and I'm just honorable. Okay, well, what are you struggling with? Nothing. Okay, well, that's not interesting. You should, right, be an honorable man that realizes that if you hold your honor, you're going to slaughter everybody you know and love. And, you know, would it be better to become a non-honorable person and save people? Or does that, some, you know, like, those are the questions that should have been asked in this movie. And they weren't, right, asked. It was just literally like, doesn't matter. Everyone's just going to go along with it. The women and children, yeah, are fine being, you know, murdered, right, if it goes that way.
Like, all the characters are sort of titles. So, one, yes, guy's the brother, the one guy's the brother-in-law, the, yep, one guy's, you know, as opposed to like, these are standalone people, like, you know, in Seven Samurai, you're talking about very complex, complicated characters with differing motivations, differing things that drive them and that are, have conflicts within them and then conflicts between characters.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, everybody is just a prop around Tom Cruise. And that's why the film is just so sort of cliche and flat and that's the point. And I'm glad that the time you did work with Tom Cruise, he taught you that lesson about.
Yeah, I mean, it was he said coming off of The Last Samurai, he said he learned, yeah, a lot from Edward Zick, and he wanted to pass along the knowledge to not make those same mistakes. And so I have a soft spot in my heart for Mr. Cruise.
And I'm glad. I'm glad you do. And I know one of your favorite movies of all time is The Mummy, starring Tom Cruise. Did you see that movie? Your face froze when I thought Zoom had kicked out on me. I just saw your eyes roll in the back of your head.
No, I have not seen the Tom Cruise Mummy.
Mostly
because of the fact that, A, I actually enjoyed the Brendan Fraser mummies. But the reason that I think The Mummy works in any way, shape, or form is if there's humor. If it's a straight, legit movie, it's like, you can't overcome that. Like, yeah, you can't make that a straight, and they're like, we're going to make it dark, like The Dark Knight. And I'm like, nope, that's not going to work. I'm sorry, guys. Let's play a different game.
Yeah, and this movie could have done with some humor, you know?
Yes.
Like, you know, Kurosawa, that's one of the great things about his film and all great filmmakers. They're able to draw humor out of drama, you know, where you're like, oh, hi, yeah, it's funny. But Tom Cruise is sort of immune to taking things that
100% way. Immune to that.
Yeah. And it's so funny when he's all in on something and he's all in on this. I remember seeing him promoting this back in the day. And I think he was on Oprah, something like that. And he was serious Tom. And Oprah's like interviewing him and he's very soft spoken. And she asks him, you know, like, oh, well, you know, what'd you think? And he's like, he basically said to her, and I think this, it's not a direct quote, but it's close, that he didn't care if he did another movie again. He would love to just sit somewhere and make rice and drink tea. And like, you know, like he had gone all method into this movie. And I'm just like, wow, he is selling this motherfucker like you wouldn't believe. You know, and we're supposed to like take him seriously as the guy who does that.
I mean, this was pre-Tom Cruise before he did all of his own stunts. So, I mean, think about what we as a world would have lost if he would have went away and drank tea and eaten rice. But conversely, can you imagine what would be burning inside Tom Cruise knowing that he could have been doing all these stunts and making money, but he was now had chosen this lifestyle to sell another movie? That's the sort of conflict that the characters in this movie needed.
Yes, it
that
is.
That didn't exist.
Which brings us to my question.
Oh, gosh.
Because I have some goddamn answers for this one, which is these are my favorite questions when I know the answer. So we're a Hollywood producer guy, and we have this story on our table. On our casting couch, which I know you're very familiar with. Who do you get to star in this movie and who do you get to direct it?
But it has to be current Hollywood, not like any.
No. Back then, back in 2003.
Oh, God. I don't.
Should I give my answers, Barry?
Yeah, I think you might have to kick it off. I gotta okay. Think about this.
I'm excited.
That's like
about
long,
this now.
That's long enough ago that like I'm trying to remember who like was supposed to be big and who became big and where they were.
I'm the answer man on this one. All so, right. 2003, sort of a weird time in Hollywood.
Yeah, it was.
You know, things are trying to people are figuring things out. Here's my choice. I have two choices that go together. So I have a director and an actor and another director and an actor. My first choice, actually, I won't even say my first choice, just a choice. Martin Scorsese and Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, I mean, that would be...
Right, coming off Gangs of New York, a movie I didn't like very much. But Scorsese, big Kurosawa guy, has since made Silence, a movie set in Japan. Which I liked quite a bit.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
I would have loved to see that. And then you're talking about the role of Nathan Algren, who is this, again, grizzled, tortured sort of alcoholic. And I'm like, wow, this guy could be sort of a cross between Bill the Butcher from Gangs of New York and the guy from There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that sort of depth and complication and soul to the part with Daniel Day-Lewis. Now, here's my second choice. And my second choice is more blockbuster, because that first one is like Oscar bait.
Yeah.
The next one is sort of still Oscar bait, but it's more populist. So 2003 is, I think, 3 years after Gladiator.
Ridley Scott.
So we're talking Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe at this point he's at the height of who he is.
Well, I think this was maybe around the time he did that movie with Meg Ryan, which was train wreck. So this might have been
that ruined Meg Ryan's marriage, by the way.
Yeah, it did.
Ruined it. Thanks, Russell.
I mean, imagine where what's his name's life would have been different.
Let's see. Oh, no. Interesting. 2001, he does A Beautiful Mind.
Yep.
Gets nominated, does not win. 2003, fascinating. Master and Commander, Far Side of the World.
Oh, yeah, that's
which is actually a much better movie than Last Samurai.
Well,
and directed by your favorite guy, Peter Weir.
I was going to say, Peter Weir would have been a person that was
I was going to say. Interesting list. Yeah, I'd put him on there.
I would definitely put him on a list. A wild card.
Yeah.
Because he's never done anything like this. But I think this was kind of in... It could have been the sort of thing where it would have been atypical type of movie for him to take, but he might have done it. And I don't know if it would have been worse or if it would have been a masterpiece, but I'm curious in a universe where Robert Zemeckis was handed the keys to this.
Oh, dear. Oh, boy. Let me see. What was Zemeckis doing back then? Let's see Zemeckis.
He might have been doing the Tom Cruise train one, Polar Express. I think that was around the time that he got interested. So, but or you was that or was What Lies Beneath?
You got him. The Polar Express, no four. Tom Hanks, not Tom Cruise. Can you imagine Polar Express could be even worse with Tom Cruise?
Yeah.
What happened with Zemeckis? So between his last movie was Castaway in 2000, and then instead of doing real movies with people in them, he makes the Polar Express in 2004, and then we're off to the races with just dog shit after that.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, if he wouldn't have gotten sucked into that, I think his visual, like in a thing like What Lies Beneath, or even Contact, he's got a skill set for the visual language, and because he's tech orientated, it would have been interesting. I'm not saying it would have been great. But I think that he would have been the type of director that would have been in on those meetings. I think Peter Weir, I think, would have knocked it out of the ballpark. I think Daniel Day-Lewis would have been a great choice. But I think at the budget level they were at, there's no way they would have cast him. So I'm trying to think. I mean, obviously, Russell Crowe would have got that film greenlit.
Yeah, that's what I think. Just Crowe brings that
He would have brought that gravitas to it. I'm trying to think of who else.
Sean Penn.
There's no way they would have greenlit $145 million.
He'd be good in that part, though.
Yeah, he would. He would be.
That's actually part he would. He would.
I think he would do very well. I think the difference with Sean Penn, he does. I mean, he's a great actor, but he always, to me, comes off a little bit too. He doesn't have enough of a soft side. Yeah. Like I would have loved to seen someone that like wrestled, but then was like angry and then had some like honor and like lightness to him. I think he could have done two of the three quadrants well. I think he would have come off a little bit, he would have left a little bit on the table if you would have cast him.
Well, then I know exactly who you would have cast. Matthew Broderick.
Yes. Well, I mean, he should be in all war movies.
He should be in every war movie.
I mean, geez. He was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He clearly should command the samurai
army. How good would Parasite have been with Matthew Broderick as the lead?
Okay.
Right? As the father of the family.
Everybody just unsubscribed from the podcast. That was maybe the silliest thing that will ever be spoken about.
I love it. And I'm joking about Matthew Broderick. I love Ferris Bueller. And Sean Penn, who I know is listening, he's a friend of mine. Barry is kidding about that stuff because Sean, he's like me, he's got a flash of a temper. So it's interesting to think about because, again, this is a great idea and a great story, but just a below average film to me. And that's because of the talents or lack thereof involved, that Zwick just can't do this sort of thing. He's not good at it. And Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise. He's going to put asses in the seats. I think Cruise followed this stuff up with his. I think War of the Worlds may have come right after this.
Yeah, I think so.
I have to check that. Checking right now. Checking, everybody. Hold on.
Pretty sure 2005 was War of the Worlds. So.
Yeah, I think you're right. Oh, thank God for Wikipedia. What do we got here? Okay. Wow. Boy, Tom Cruise does work a lot, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
He did Collateral after this and then War of the Worlds. There you go.
I mean, he followed up with two movies better than this one.
He definitely did. Good for him. All right. So any final thoughts about The Last Samurai, Barry, before we let everybody go and do their thing?
Well, I've seen some movies on the various streaming platforms that are infinitely worse than this movie. So if you haven't seen this movie or haven't seen it in a while and you're deep, deep, deep into your like suggested films, check this one out. If you have ample, if you have your, you know, AFI's 100 films of all time that you haven't gotten through yet, maybe stick to that one in the short term. Or if you just want to, kind of, you know, turn off your brain and not think about anything and not care that not everything makes a whole lot of sense. It's 2.5 hours. It'll feel like 3.5 hours. And
yeah, if you want a 2.5 hour movie that feels like a 7 hour movie, this is the one for you. No, but it, I mean, look, it is what it is. It's a really sort of conventional Hollywood movie in that sense, which, you know, you can turn your brain off and watch it, or you could watch it sort of critically and have fun with it. You know, but just, it's not like you got anything else to do. I don't recommend the movie, but you can still watch it and, like, you know, it won't be the worst thing you've ever done, and I hope. You know, so there it is. I'm not a fan. I want to reiterate before we go, this was Barry's pick. Barry picked this one, man.
I have one last thought, and I wanted to let everybody know that your family celebrated a birthday this week, and we wanted to wish them a happy birthday.
Thank you, buddy. Yeah, we did. Not my birthday, by the way. my son had the turn 5 on Wednesday. Big day.
I mean, I know that's when midlife crisis kicks in, so we'll wish you and yours the best of luck.
It certainly is for me, man. It's like living with a tornado. He's like, get me out of this house, man. Enough. But yeah, so we had a big week this week, and I'm busy, and, you know, life goes on.
Yeah.
So hopefully there won't be any riots in LA, although I won't hold my breath on that count. We're pretty good at it out here.
You started it. We're continuing it. We'll see what your movie pick is next week, and we'll see. We go from there.
Yeah, buckle up, everybody. We're in the dregs right now. But we'll find something.
All righty, man.
All righty. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time.